Gamble. And I did get various questions submitted last evening, and so I'm going to work through some of those. And if during this question and answer time it reminds you of something that you would like to ask, or if it raises a question, please go ahead and feel free to ask a follow-up question. And we'll just see how we'll go till roughly, you know, maybe for the next 20 minutes or so. Then we'll try to get the room back in shape for our breakout session in a few minutes with Pastor Sean Mathis from Denver. So let me begin by just asking a basic question. If someone wants to learn more about Calvin, is there a particular biography that you would say this is the best, this is the most definitive biography on Calvin's life? And so what would you recommend?
Can you hear me okay if I don't lean forward?
They're saying no.
No, okay. All right. There are a number of Calvin biographies, and I don't highly recommend any of them. The best one, if you want a lot of detail on Calvin's early life, is a book written by a Roman Catholic guy. Matter of fact, a Roman Catholic priest wrote the best biography of the young Calvin, and he's an Eastern European by the name of Alexander Gonoxy. So he's Catholic, and he views things from Catholic perspective, but he's a great historian, and he doesn't mess it up in terms of the theology. So many of the contemporary biographies of Calvin are written by theologians who want Calvin to say what they believe. So one of the most popular Calvin biographies is written by a British guy by the name of Parker, Thomas Henry Lewis, T.H.L. Parker. It's published by Westminster John Knox Press, and that's probably the most one of the most readable biographies. Dr. Parker's a friend for a long, long time, and he's a follower of the modern theologian Karl Barth. And so Parker's Calvin happens to be a Barthian. So that nix that one. There's another later biography of Calvin. Was published by Oxford University Press, and that one, his name's Bousma, B-O-U-W-S-M-A, and he's also a friend. And Bousma was a professor of history, and he's a Dutch Reformed background, and his father was a very famous philosopher by the name of O.K. Bousma. But Bousma's biography of Calvin is as much a psychoanalysis of Bousma trying to figure out his relationship to his own father. So there's a whole bunch of stuff on Calvin and Calvin's relationship to his father, which, in fact, we have almost no evidence on their relationship. But so nix that one, too. There's an old French one that's been translated by a guy named Vondel, and that's a good one. That's okay. And one or two other ones, but in fact, there's none that I really, really endorse. So.
What do you think of Baze's?
Baze's biography of Calvin. Now, help me out. Is that available in English? Well, I'll be. Is that so? Well, it's wonderful, but I didn't know it was available. Yeah, it's very good. And, of course, Beza loved Calvin. And so Calvin's flaws aren't there, but Beza's biography is wonderful and shows what I know. I have it, but it's in Latin. So I didn't even know that it was available. So good. Thank you for the question. Read it in English.
Catherine.
I'm sorry?
Any biographies for kids on Calvin's life that you've read?
You know, I don't know. Now, there's a novel on Edelette. Do you have that? And that's really a fun read. That was written by the wife of, really? It was written by Mrs. Van Halsema, and Dr. Van Halsema was a wonderful, godly man, and well, yeah, that's not bad, too. Her husband wasn't so bad, either. He was, yeah. So Edna Gerstner's is very good, too. But one of the problems, I was talking with the bookstore people in the back about biographies of Calvin. One of the problems, remember last night I mentioned that the horse and the Rhine River and all that stuff, and we lost all of Calvin's early records. And it's only in the last 20 years, actually, that we've transcribed in 20 volumes the minutes of the full minutes of the Consistory of Geneva during Calvin's ministry. And it was published in Geneva in 16th century French. And when I taught at Calvin Seminary, the last thing I did on the last day was to make a deal with Bill Erdman's for him to English all 20 volumes, and that's coming out now. And so a lot of the lectures material that I gave you last night and some of the stuff that I'll give you today is actually from those consistory minutes, which, in fact, weren't available 20 years ago. So there should be some new biographies. And there have been some wonderful new discussions. There have been two doctoral dissertations done that have been published from doctoral students who were working on these 20 volumes. And so, for example, there's a... this is not popular, but a high-level discussion of marriage and divorce in Calvin's Geneva, looking at the consistory records. And there's kids here, so I won't go into details, but, man, there was stuff going on in Geneva that is really adult material. And the consistory, the pastors and the elders had to deal with, I mean, pastor, you think you've got problems, they had problems. I can go into a lot of detail on that and kind of do it PG rated. But so there's been a lot of study on Calvin granted the first divorce, for example, in Geneva, and what were the grounds for divorce? How did these things work out? So in the future, I think there'll be quite a bit of new material on the biography.
For those in the Springs, I have the first volume of the Consistory Minutes, if anyone wants to peruse those.
Like $60 or something like that?
They're expensive. And I heard that, actually, there's a question whether that project's going to go through with Erdman's. It's been somewhat shelved.
I left.
So, but it's an incredible read. And I've taken courage as a pastor and feeling the empathy that here's guys who went through the same stuff. They were dealing with the same issues. There really is nothing new under the sun. And, but lots of wisdom there. So, but speaking of maybe that we could segue into Calvin granting the first divorce, did Calvin have any siblings? And if so, any stories? That's what the question says.
Well, not a lot. Calvin had a brother, and I mentioned him last night, and he had a rebellious wife. They stayed married, Calvin's brother was faithful to Calvin and a good friend. Those are the only. That's the only sibling that Calvin had who survived. And then, of course, they had the son who died, Jacques. And then Calvin had the two stepchildren.
And is it correct? His mother died when he was six.
Right.
And
his dad died when he was a teenager, late teenager.
But did his dad? Didn't he have two half sisters from his dad's second marriage? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. I think one of them accompanied, she and her husband, who was a minister, accompanied Calvin into exile as well.
But ask him.
I don't.
He knows more about it.
I don't know 100%. I just things I'd read. What were his parents like? Do we know much about his parents? Or you were saying a second ago about the one biography that we actually really don't know much about him and his relationship with his parents, obviously his mom dying at six, but do we know anything about his parents?
Calvin's father was an upper-middle-class guy, and he wanted Calvin to go into the church, not for pious reasons, but because that was an avenue of power. So Calvin was planning to be a priest, again, just because that was a good thing. But actually, his father was a secretary or a clerk to the local bishop, and his dad got into some trouble. So his dad switched his studies and sent him to law school instead of into the priesthood. So.
I had read as well. His brother? I think his brother took a post as a priest for a while, but then ended up not pursuing that. Once they got to Geneva, Calvin took over the role of minister, and his mm-hmm. brother ended up in publishing. Mm-hmm. I think and published a lot of his works, if I remember right. What last night, as you were beginning, you were talking about the importance of biography before we before we look at a man's output of his work, his theology. What about the man's life? What was he like as a husband? What was he like as a father? And you had made those comments, and we heard a bit about his devotion to his wife and his love for his wife. Could you elaborate a little bit further on what he was like as a father?
Hmm. No, I really can't. His own child died at 2 weeks, so he didn't father his own child. His stepson, when they got married, was already 13, so he was in the 16th century
already
on the verge of manhood.
Yeah.
I didn't talk about his stepdaughter very much. His stepdaughter lived with him, and we don't know much about her except she left the church. And she left Geneva. We talked a little bit about the students being sent off to death. And one of the details about life in the seminary in Geneva was there's no dormitories. So the Calvin household, because he was employed by the city of Geneva, we know like how many gallons of wine were consumed in a week at the Calvin house. How many, for example, Edelette, baked at least 20 loaves of bread per week herself, and if you've made bread, you don't have that electric thing that goes. So they had a massive household, and the seminary students lived with the Calvin family. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they saw Calvin interacting with family, and so for me, that's why. Thinking about Calvin's relationship to his students, at seminary we come close to our students, but not that close. We don't live in the same house. We don't share three meals a day. So we know a lot about his life, but not so much as a father. But anyway, concerning the stepdaughter, she fell in love with one of the students, and they sinned together and left Geneva, and that's the end. That's at least all I know about her life. So that's all I know.
Yeah, John.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. In the 16th century, there was no notion of the separation of church and state as we Americans understand it. As a matter of fact, it was the strife in the city of Geneva was precisely on the issue of the relationship between the church and the city magistrates or the state. So even today, for example, in Switzerland, if you're a minister in the Swiss Reformed Church, you're a state employee. And if you're a member of the Swiss Reformed Church, your tithe is taken automatically out of your paycheck. It's not an option. It's efficient, yeah. So, this is till today. You're a state employee if you're a minister in the state church of Switzerland. So, you can see how difficult it would be. So you've got Pastor Dave here, pastoring the church, and A.T. here is a local magistrate, and he's a member of the congregation, and he's been a bad boy, And Dave says, now we're going to have communion next week. You may not come. You're under discipline. But you just happen to be, you know, vice mayor. And you sign his paycheck. And you can imagine how tense that situation would be. Wait a minute, I'm your boss. And in fact, the magistrates were his boss. So Calvin spent his entire life fighting and losing in the fight to separate church discipline from civil discipline. And the whole story is very complex and very different from anything that we experience here in America. I'd be glad to talk more, but I hope I answered the question.
Greg.
Oh, my heavens, yes. So this was one of the major areas of debate. I happen to have an article on this. It was published in 1985 in the Westminster Theological Journal. It's Beza and Knox on political resistance theory. It's the difference between Calvin and Knox as it relates to the nature of the lesser magistrate and how all these things come together. So let me try to give a real quick answer. Ask the question again, so I can try to do it again.
A new thing in Scotland, when we think of the Reformation, so much of the Reformation was the civil magistrate saying, okay, we're a Lutheran town.
Yes.
We're whatever, we're Catholic, and that's driven by the civil magistrate. A new thing in Scotland was the church not being answerable to the state as such.
Okay. See, now I get the question better, and I'm not sure that the presuppositions of the question, I'm not sure that I'm with you.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure that Scotland was able to do that. I mean, you have the state church of Scotland. And even the Westminster divines, who invited them to come together? It was the Parliament. It's the Reformed Presbyterian Church that was a little bit different. So that was part of my problem with the question. It's the RPs who are weird in terms of this. The normal way of thinking is still union of church and state, the civil magistrate and the church working hand in glove in Scotland as well.
Let me ask another question that was brought in. With all Calvin's busyness and work, do we know of any other interests that he had outside of the work of reform? And
you know, when I was in Grand Rapids, there was this thing called the Meter Center for Calvin Studies that I was heading up. And we did a movie on Calvin, a popular movie with a professional actor playing Calvin. And the people who were paying for the movie really wanted Calvin to look very human. So they said to me, okay, tell me what Calvin's hobbies were so we can have him doing his hobbies in the movie. And I looked and I looked. He didn't have any hobbies. So we made one up. And it was a game called in French clay, which means key. And have you ever taken a key or something? You know, they had big keys in those days. Or sometimes you fold up paper and make a triangle, and you try to make it go to the edge of the table, you know, and the one who can get it. So we had Calvin playing clay. But it was a fake. I mean, there's a rumor that he used to play tennis on Sundays. That's not verifiable. So, brothers and sisters, why would we expect that Calvin would have hobbies? He got up in the morning and he began to work, and when it was nighttime, he went to sleep. That was what he was called to do.
Another question that you touched there that came in is, can you discuss Calvin's view of the Sabbath and the debates that rage over that issue?
The best book on that was written by my former colleague Richard Gaffin, and it's called Calvin and the Sabbath. It was his THM thesis at Westminster Seminary that eventually was published. And actually, Gaffin and I both disagree with Calvin on parts of his view of the Sabbath. Calvin, as an early reformer, was thinking through things, and so Calvin's view of the Sabbath, I think, was not as well as articulated as what we have in the Westminster Confession. I think that we can make them fit, but it's a little hard because he's just not as mature. The one place where I disagree is I see the Sabbath as a creation ordinance, if that's a meaningful thing, and Calvin didn't. He saw it as coming from the Decalogue rather than as a creation ordinance. So that's the place where Gaffin and I disagree. But the best book on that is by Dick Gaffin. So on Sunday in Geneva, basically, if you're Presbyterian, whatever we do is what he did. So he closed everything. So I'm from Pennsylvania. And as a boy in Pennsylvania, believe it or not, the entire state was shut down on Sundays. I mean, you couldn't buy food, you couldn't buy gas. I mean, the businesses were closed a thousand years ago when I was born. that's what happened in Geneva. So there was very, very strict legislation. So inns, for example, when travelers were coming through, inns were to stay open. But during the times of public worship, everything had to be shut down so that everyone would be free to worship. So he had in function as strict a Sabbatarian view as any right-wing OP or PCA or RP person would have, and legislated it that way.
Yeah, Jason.
Wonderful question. I'll be talking about that in the second lecture some today. When you sign the Confession of Faith, if you understand what you're signing, you're saying that you've been saved, that you've been united to Christ. And probably the most important function that we do, whether we're magistrates, preachers, teachers, is to worship the one who died for us. So it was extremely important to do everything possible to make it possible for all the Genevan citizens on the Sabbath to be able to worship twice. So the idea of morning and evening that's part of the Westminster Confession goes back to Calvin, that they worship twice as a symbol for the whole day. So the beginning and the end of the day. You really can't spend 12 hours in public worship, but the beginning and the end of the day was the symbol for setting aside the whole day. And yes, so just like many of us as pastors, as we wrestle with issues of the Sabbath and like going to restaurants and Walmart's open and, well, we need it, we need to go buy tea bags. Calvin was very strong in making sure that the lower classes of people were free that day. And that's still a struggle that we have today. The people who are working on the restaurants on Sunday that we might go to, the waitresses and the cooks, these are the people who maybe don't have as many choices in life as the rest of us. And in a sense, we oppress them by doing business on Sunday. So basically some of the issues that we face, he faced, except because of the union of church and state, they were actually able to legislate it just like the good old days in Pennsylvania.
Are there other writings from Calvin that are not translated into English? And if so, do they contain material that would significantly alter what we understand to be his thinking or view on any major doctrine or theological issue?
The only thing that's not translated are a few letters, but everything's been translated and nothing would change.
Who was Servetus and did Calvin burn him at the stake?
There was a physician by the name of Servetus, and Servetus was insane. He was nuts. He was an anti-Trinitarian. He was brilliant. Medical historians say that he beat Harvey for developing the circulation of blood. He was physician to the King of Spain. I mean, the guy was a genius. Wrote theology books as well as medical books. He was condemned as a heretic by the Lutherans, the Roman Catholics, and the Reformed. He was truly a heretic. Calvin and Servetus have extensive correspondence. One little known part of Calvin's life was that Servetus, they'd been writing, and again, Servetus was brilliant, but I think had an unregenerated heart. And he wrote to Calvin and said, maybe we'll come to faith if you will come and personally talk with me about these things instead of correspondence. So Calvin made a secret trip to Paris to meet with Servetus. Now, you already know from last night, he was condemned. I mean, if he would have been caught anywhere in France, he would have been executed. So at risk of his own life, he'd made this trip to Paris, went to the place, agreed upon place, and of course Servetus didn't even show up. So they have correspondence after that, and Servetus says that he's going to stop by Geneva. And Calvin says, please don't. Please, let's only correspond. You are a public enemy. Now, heresy in the 16th century was considered like murder. I mean, heretics were considered more socially dangerous than murderers. So he said, if you show up in Geneva and anybody recognizes you, I can't guarantee your safety. Nevertheless, he came to Geneva. And as a matter of fact, in the middle of a worship service, stood up and started shouting. So he made sure that he was arrested. Now, he had been arrested just less than a year earlier by the Roman Catholics, condemned to death, but was rich enough to pay off the guards to escape from prison. So the man was just not stable. I'm giving a long answer, but I'm trying to be as short as I can. I mean, I can tell you how many times Calvin visited Servetus in prison. I can tell you the nature of those conversations because it was all recorded. And Calvin pled with him and reasoned with him, but it was like talking to a rock. Furthermore, Calvin, who was not even a citizen of Geneva, had nothing to do with the formal or material execution of Servetus. It was done by the magistrates, not by the church. So he was, as a heretic, again, it's a political offense in the 16th century. Furthermore, the council records indicate that Calvin argued he was in favor of Servetus being executed. There's no question. Luther, Calvin, everybody wanted to see Servetus die. Now, whether that's right or wrong, that's another question. I mean, for us, that just isn't comprehensible. But Calvin also pled to have him beheaded rather than burned, because that's a hideous way to die. The city magistrate formally rejected Calvin's pleas to them for the change in the execution, and they did execute Servetus.
Maybe two more questions, and then I think we're going to have to call this, and you'll have to get your question to Dr. Gamble in between sessions. Speaking of Beza's biography of Calvin, what do you think his biggest weaknesses or greatest flaws were?
Calvin's. Toward the end of his life, Calvin had time to reflect, and Calvin himself gives us a list of his greatest weaknesses. He knew better than I do. At times he was very impatient. Because of his intellectual abilities, at times he really struggled dealing with people who were not as able, and really wrestled with that, and wrestled, for example, as there was such a need for men in the ministry, how strict should the requirements be? How capable should the man be? What if he's just not the brightest bulb in the pack? Should he still be able to be a minister? So Calvin had a short temper, I think, at times, and was not able to deal with less gifted people, I think, at times as well.
What about his most underappreciated contribution to the church? What would you say that we know Calvin popularly in certain areas, but is there an underappreciated area of his work?
Yeah. The Calvinism, the notion of Calvinism and the name Calvin generally elicits a response from people, doesn't it? You know, you're a Calvinist, you know, so your God's a tyrant, right? Why is that name so well known? Well, I think what's underappreciated is that Calvin was also able deeply to love people like Beza. I mean, Beza loved Calvin, and there were hundreds of his students and his colleagues who just loved him and were loved by him. Because we have so many volumes of his letters are beautiful works in pastoral theology. He had a pastor's heart that produced a following. Now, he was strongly against the word Calvinism. I don't use the word Calvinism. I talk about the Reformed tradition or the Reformed faith, because Calvin would throw up at the idea. Nevertheless, I think that's underappreciated. We see him as this cold theologian or this ivory tower theologian, and we forget how many weddings he did and how many baptisms he did and how deep the depth of his friendships with others.
And final question, given that volatile response that's often there when Calvin is brought up, how would you suggest people going about maybe introducing somebody who has a preconceived idea of Calvin? What would be a helpful way to get them to at least consider his work without the rhetoric and the...
Well, there's Calvin, the name Calvin oftentimes is a stumbling block, just like the word covenant sometimes is a stumbling block. You know, so if you say you're a covenant theologian, automatically people go, and then they stop talking to you. So avoid the name Covenant and avoid the name Calvin and talk about this Genevan guy or something. And then once they seem sympathetic, say, oh, by the way, it was Calvin. So sneak it in the back door, I guess.
We need to close our time at this point, and so we are going to do that. We need some help getting the room in shape here. We'd like to get it snapped into shape in about 15 minutes, so if we could get the plates put away and if guys could help with tables and putting chairs back, that would be wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Gamble, for indulging us.